We're going to get into the book of Malachi here. We've gotten into it last time, so we're going to continue in the book of Malachi, and we're going to look at begin in chapter 2 and go on through it, through all of the remaining portion of chapter 2. In the first study, I mentioned that Malachi was a book that is unique. And so we have to keep that in mind as we go through it. The book of Malachi is unique because God is speaking to the people of Judah. And the interesting thing about what's happening there is God speaks to the people of Judah. And unfortunately, they push back against God. So God is seeking to correct them and to put them on the right track. And the Jews had reached such a state as followers of God that they were not listening to God. In fact, they would push back at God, as we'll see. So it's unique in that way. And the fact that God is giving you information and you're pushing back against it tells you the spiritual state that they were in. They were lacking in humility. And they were most definitely unwilling to repent. And there are, as we'll see by the time we finish, that there were dire consequences to that mindset. It's not surprising that Malachi brings to an end the Old Testament period, because what happened was that the people of Judah have unfortunately not heeded God. They've been pushing back at God, and God basically judges them unteachable. So I can't teach you. There's nothing that I'm going to impart to you. So we're going to part ways. Jews, as they look at the book of Malachi, they do see it as the end of the prophets. That's not the last book in the Hebrew Bible. The last book in the Hebrew Bible is Second Chronicles. They end a little bit differently than our Protestant version of the Bible. They end their book in a different spot, but the books are all the same. So the intro brings us to Malachi chapter 1:1-5. We're not going to read all those verses. We went through them last time. And as you look at those verses, Malachi chapter 1, verses 1-5, basically it provides the foundation for the whole book. The proposition that's formed at the beginning of that is that God says, I have demonstrated my love to you. So God had shown them that he loved them, and he had not just said that he loved them, but he had demonstrated it. It's just like for us as Christians, has God demonstrated his love to all of us? Well, he's done so in a most graphic way, in that he sent his son into this world to die for the sins of the world. So he demonstrated through the sacrifice of the Son of God that he loves us, and in fact loves us to the extent that he was willing to lay down his life for us. And so God demonstrated that, and it is something that that was important to the way that God was dealing with them. He had demonstrated that he did love them. But and they made it very hard for God to love them because of the way they were. You know, when you're trying to help somebody, which is what correction is all about, if they push back all the time and never listen, never heed anything you say, then it can become quite frustrating. So from this point on, as we're getting into the book, that it's a back and forth battle with a people who have become so morally and spiritually dysfunctional that they only want to do what is right in their own sight. They don't want to heed God. They don't want to give in to God. And this is the way they were as the New Testament unfolds and Christ comes into the world. And you see this manifested in Christ's dealings with the people of his time. So they had declined morally, declined spiritually, and they had decided the path that they were going to follow, and basically they were wanting God to approve what they were planning on doing and how they were approaching life. And God said, sorry, I can't approve that. And if that's what you want me to do, then we're going to have to part ways. And basically, the people of Judah were telling God, if you're not going to endorse what we're doing, then please leave us alone. We went through Malachi 1:6 through 2:9, which basically covers God setting aside Aaron and his sons and the Levites to serve as leaders in Israel, to serve as teachers, as priests, as officiants in the worship service, and to judge the people. They had very important responsibilities, and they were trained in those responsibilities in order that they could provide a structure for the people of Judah and give them guidance and direction when they needed it, especially when it came to spiritual things. And unfortunately, the people that God designated to be the leaders in Israel did a very poor job. They had been given these tremendous responsibilities in the temple and to lead the people, and they failed. And so God worked with them and tried to correct them and put them on the right track. And eventually God says, okay, I'm not gonna force you to do these things. It's something that you need to recognize and put into practice. And as we ended the study last time, I made the point that between the time of Malachi and the coming of Jesus Christ, the priests came to be replaced in most all of their responsibilities, except for officiating at the temple. So they still did the sacrifices, and they were still involved in the temple to some extent, but the other jobs that the priest had were taken over by the Pharisees. So as you go and look at the history, what was happening was the people of Judah had declined and were going in the wrong direction, and there was a group of Jews that decided that they were going downhill as a people and losing their heritage, spiritually speaking. So that's where the Pharisees came on the scene, and they were willing to step up to the plate and fill in where the leaders that God had designated were failing. So they were willing to step into those positions. They had no right to do so. God did not designate them as the leaders in Israel, but they nobody else was stepping up, so the Pharisees did, and they filled the positions that the priest once held. Interestingly, between the time of Christ, which is around 30 AD, up until 130 AD, you had at 130s, you had, and in 70 AD, you had the destruction of the temple, and the worship of God continued, and the people that God had designated as leaders in Judah continued to lead up until about 130. And in 130, you had a second major revolt called the Bar Kokhba revolt, and with that, the priests basically lost all of their duties and responsibilities. The only thing that remains to a large extent as far as the leaders that God designated are, you know, you have names like Cohen, you have names that clearly relate to the fact that the people are Jewish, and that they have the name, but they have no duties, no responsibilities. So as you look at this, you're coming up on a transition between the leaders of the Jews and the priesthood, and things are being sorted out here in Christ's time. So let's go to Malachi chapter 2, verse 10. Malachi chapter 2, verse 10. And in Malachi 2, verse 10, we transition to another topic. In verse chapter 2, verse 10, it says, have we not all one Father? So they looked at it as we are all Jews, and as Jews, we have one Father. It says, has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers? And the one father that they all have is appropriately in verse 10 capitalized, like it says there, have we not all one father? And that one father would be God. As you looked at the Jews and their understanding of their history, they did have one father. They would look to Abraham as their father in a certain sense, as the founder of the nation. And then you have Moses as the father of the state. He is the one that led Israel out of Egypt, and he is the one upon which the nation is founded after they left Egypt. So they have multiple fathers, as you can see, an ethnic father in Abraham, a father of statehood in Moses. And because depending on the context, then what do you mean by we all have one father? And it could mean different things based upon the context. And God is saying here, he is their father, and that they have dealt treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers. So they all have one father, and they've entered into covenant with God, but the way that they have conducted themselves has profaned the covenant that God made with the fathers. So the covenant of the father is broad enough that it could be taken in several different directions. And chapter 2, verse 11 says, Judah has dealt treacherously. So, you know, if somebody is dealing treacherously, they're up to no good, and they have no good intentions for you. And they have dealt treacherously with one another and with God. And it goes on to say, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution, which he loves. He has married the daughter of a foreign god. So he's accusing them of dealing treacherously and committing an abomination, something that is of grave offense to God. And God established something holy, and he meant for the Jews and Israel to deal with him in a way of integrity, and they have not done so. They've actually profaned the Lord's institution, which he loves. And it says, he has married the daughter of a foreign god. So there's actually an institution. It's a holy institution, which was to be kept holy by the way that they observed it, but unfortunately they did not do so. And part of that was the way they profaned it was by marrying the daughters of foreign gods. So let's look at a few more details about that. What does that mean? In Malachi chapter 2, verse 12, it says, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this, being awake and aware, yet who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. So as you look at what is said here in verse 12, it's actually pronouncing a curse on the people of Judah. It says, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob. So to be cut off from the tents of Jacob is a rather serious thing and is not a blessing in any way, shape, or form. He says to cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this, being awake and aware. So you know exactly what you're doing. And so you're very much awake and aware of what you're doing. And this is something that God takes offense to. And then the second curse is yet who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. And what he means there is that, look, they're profaning the holy institution that God established, and then they are bringing offerings to God for the person who's actually profaning this institution. And the priest should have said, no, you cannot offer that because of the way that you're living. And so they were cut off from God, and they were cursed. And he says, may the Lord cut off the person who brings in offering to the Lord of hosts when your heart's not right and you're not bringing something in with the right attitude and the right approach. And God said, I won't accept it. So he's saying, if this is the route that you're going to go down, and we don't have a relationship. If this is your approach, we do not have a relationship. There's no relationship here because they're profaning things. And God says, I don't want anybody coming to me on your behalf and pleading for you when you're not doing it the way that you should be doing it. You're actually bringing profane offerings and sacrificing them on my altar. So God wanted the people he was addressing to understand the magnitude of the offense. He wanted them to understand this is most serious, and you need to be aware of it and take the action necessary to resolve the problem. So as you look at what it's talking about here, where it's talking about marrying the daughters of a foreign god, what's that all about? And it was a problem that was pretty widespread after Judah returned to the land of Palestine. You can go to the end of the book of Chronicles and you'll see the problem. You can go through the book of Ezra, you'll see the problem. You can go through the book of Nehemiah and you can see the problem. And you can also see references to the problem in the minor prophets. And so let me just kind of lay out the topic for you to help you to better understand it. If you go back to the time when Israel was conquered by the Assyrians and taken into captivity, well, they pulled all the people of Israel out where there were not a lot of people left in the land. And so what did they do? They gathered up people from around their dominion, around their empire, and they brought some of those people back to the land of Israel and placed them back in the land. They weren't all the same people. They were a mix of people that were brought back and allowed to take residence in the land. And these were varied people from various parts of the empire. And so being different people, they also brought their different gods. And so they came into the land and they had a variety of gods that they brought with them. And they sought to continue the worship of those gods. However, they also had a superstition that was common at the time. So if you come from your land, wherever it happened to be, you brought your God with you. But when you came into the land of Israel, there were other gods in the land of Israel. And so what they sought to do is figure out, well, who are these gods? And to seek to appease them, to seek to have a relationship with them, because they most assuredly did not want the gods of the land of Israel to be unhappy with them. And their way of looking at things was that gods were territorial. For instance, in 2 Kings chapter 1, it talks about the Baal of Ekron. Beelzebub was the god of Ekron. And so Beelzebub was the god of Ekron, and Baal was God there in that community. But once you got outside or to the outskirts of that community, then his power stopped. And you got into another God's domain. And so that was their, this was nonsense, but it was what they believed at the time, that gods had different territories. And so what they wanted when they came into the land of Israel is they wanted somebody who knew the God of Israel. And so what did they do? They sent a priest back from who were formerly priests in Israel and sent them back into the land in order that they could give them guidance on worshiping the God of the land of Israel. And since they hoped that they would have a familiarity with who that God was. So you had varied people who moved into the land of Israel, and they brought their gods with them. But following the superstition of the time, they said that they brought their own gods, but they also sought to honor the God who dwelled in the land. And so they wanted to know who that was, and then implement worship accordingly. So, and what they were doing is with their worship of God was they were seeking to appease the gods. That's how ancient worship, pagan worship worked, was to appease the god. You didn't want to make him mad. So if you made him mad in some way, you had to make sure to appease that god with an offering or to give that god something that would calm the anger and not end up with you being suffering as a consequence of your disrespecting the god. So they wanted to make sure that they were in a right relationship with the god of the land, and so they tried to make sure that they covered that base with in their worship. It's also the way demons work with false worship, that it's the same thing, that the god is angry and you seek to appease that god. So the people who had been brought into the land by the Assyrians, and trying to appease their gods and the God of the land of Israel, created a religion that was a mix of their gods and their understanding, and it was and so they mixed some of the true religion, false religion, paganism, all mixed together. And so it was basically, you could say it was a jumbled mess. And this was the condition of the land of Israel and Judah when the people of Judah returned. It was a jumbled mess with all these different gods and a god in different communities. And it was all just a big mess of various aspects of religion. So, for example, if you look at the city of Samaria, the people that lived in Samaria were not from Samaria. They were brought in by the Assyrians. They came in and they dwelled in the location where the ancient city of Samaria was. So they became to be called Samaritans, but they were from some land further east in the Assyrian Empire. And they had brought their religion, and they had come into contact with the true religion of the Jews, and they had mixed the two up. They had mixed them together to form some new religion, not the true religion at all, but some of the true religion may have been absorbed into it, but it wasn't the true religion. So when and as you look at them, they have come back to the land, they've established themselves in the land, and then here come the Jews. So they were anything but happy about the fact that the Jews had returned from the east and had taken up residence once again in the land of promise. They weren't happy about that at all. But they, as you read the Bible, it seems to indicate that they were trying to make friends with the Jews and trying to help the Jews, and the Jews did not accept their help, because I think the Jews could see that they did not have good intentions. They could see that, they could recognize it, and they recognized that these people were going to basically subvert what they wanted to do as they became reestablished in the land. So the Jews rejected them and did not want the, and so they you did not have this a positive relationship between the Jews and the Samaritans. That's just one of the people from the surrounding land that was seeking to undermine the Jews, and the Jews found out very quickly that they were there and seeking to undermine what the Jews were seeking to accomplish. And the people of the land stirred up trouble. They would send representatives to the king of the Persia and seek to stir things up and accuse the Jews and seek to stop the Jews from rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the city of Jerusalem and basically becoming reestablished as a nation. They did their best to undermine it and undercut it and attack it. And so the Jews took a negative approach to this and were antagonistic to the peoples who were in the land who were seeking to subvert their efforts. Over time, because people are not totally dedicated to the project or goal, unfortunately, this was true of the Jews. God had given them certain things to carry out, like clearly they were to come back, they were to rebuild the temple, they were to reestablish the true worship. And as you look through the books of Zechariah and you see there and other places that they weren't doing what they were supposed to, so God sent Haggai and Zechariah to correct the people of Judah and put them on track. And you know, we see an example that the Jews did respond and they did pull it together and they did get the temple rebuilt, but they didn't fix all of their problems. They did not turn completely to God, but they did get it together at least to be able to finish the temple. And unfortunately, when a people comes into a land and they're dealing with adversaries all around them, you seek to, you know, humanly, you try to find a way to solve the problem. How can we live more peacefully with the surrounding people? So what was the solution they came up with? It's a common solution that you find wherever you have kingdoms. What did kings do in order to ensure relations with their neighbors? Didn't they have their daughters marry the king from another kingdom? And that way they were joined together, and hopefully it would promote peace between the two groups of people. And that was the tactic that the Jews followed. They sought to compromise, and they sought to take the daughters of the people that were there before them and marry them and vice versa. So they had all of this going on. And as you go through and read like Ezra 10 and Nehemiah 13, you find out that Ezra and Nehemiah noticed the problem. They noticed that the people of Judah were in danger because of this particular approach. Because as you go back in Judah's, in Israel's history, go back and look at the situation with Balaam. Balaam sought to introduce the people of Israel to false religion. And he came up with the bright idea of sending out the women of Moab, and they would interact with the people of Israel. And as a result of that, Israel would compromise, spiritually speaking, and the result would be God would curse them, which he did. And that's been God's approach all the way along. So if you compromise with the true religion, then you're going to have a problem with God. So it's interesting as you examine Ezra 10, Ezra returned to the land of Judah. And after his return to Judah, Ezra was going around the country in general, just seeing how things were going. And he was appalled that when he went out to the edges of the country, where you had the Jews and the people that already dwelled in the land, the foreign peoples, their cultures would intersect. They lived close to each other. And when he would go out to those territories where the people of Judah and the surrounding people intersected, what he found was that you had children that could not speak Jewish. They were not at all familiar with God's way of life, and basically they had become Gentiles by intermarrying with the people around them. And so people were intermarrying with the Philistines, the people of Tyre, the Samaritans, the Moabites. And what was happening is the people of Judah were compromising with their religion. And that's where this idea of marrying a false god comes into play. So you had a fuzzy border, you had intermarriage, and as Ezra went around as an observer, he saw what the compromise with the surrounding peoples was causing. And that intermarriage with the surrounding people was marriage that brought the false god with it. That's where this god comes into play here. Because when you marry somebody of another religion to you, and you have to be careful with that. So the marriage Ezra observed was that they were getting involved with false worship instead of staying with the true worship. And the Jews in their religious weakness simply absorbed whatever was going on around them. And this is very clearly condemned in the book of Ezra and other places. Ezra 10 is probably a chapter that for all of us living in our time is actually very surprising. It would tend to blow our minds because it's not the way that we would look at things. Ezra is so appalled that he brings together all the leadership to decry the adulteration of the returning Jewish community. So they've compromised and they've lost sight of the true religion. And what happens is Ezra seeks to fight against this and seeks to put the people back on track. Ezra tells the people that the only solution to this is that every foreign wife is to be sent back to the nation from which she came, and any children that had been born into the relationship were to go back with her. And I mean, that's where I said this is a mind-blowing event, because we would never even consider such a thing in our time. The captivity event had so impacted the people of Judah that this did ring true for them, because they recognized that the reason we went into captivity was because of our failure to live God's way of life. We didn't live God's, we weren't faithful to God, and so God punished us for that. And here we are, is what Ezra was noticing, we're right on the same path once again. And so that's why he takes this dramatic step to try to get them back on the right track. So they were quite impressed by what they had gone through in the past, and they could see that if we don't change things, then we're going to go down that path once again. So the people of Judah made the decision to send all the wives and the children back to the land that the women were from. And any Jewish man who said, well, I'm not going to do that, well, fine, you don't have to do it, but you're going to have to go back to the land your wife was from. You're not going to be able to continue to live in Judah. So as you look at this, it seems so extreme, but what was the issue that Malachi was dealing with? He was dealing with idolatry. He was dealing with idolatry and seeking to correct the idolatry in the land of Judah. So as people look at this and don't fully grasp what God's intention was, they find contradictions in the scriptures, because you find Ezra making this decision. But if you look at other instances in the scriptures, you find, well, wait a minute, that wasn't universally applied. For instance, you find what are apparent contradictions. We know that God banned the marrying of Israel with Moab and Ammon, but where was Ruth from? Ruth was a Moabitess, and she became a part of the bloodline of Jesus Christ. You had Joseph having an Egyptian wife, and Ephraim and Manasseh being half Egyptian. And then you have Rahab being a Canaanite, and she also becomes a part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. And then you look at Moses. Moses, who did he marry? He married a Midianite. So you have all of these intermarriages with foreign ladies, and God seems to approve of it. And the reason he approved of it is because all of these ladies, as they married, they became a part of Israel and adopted the God of Israel. They left their God behind. And so you look at Rahab, or you look at Joseph's wife, or Ruth, they had to have abandoned their gods and accepted the God of Israel. And so as they accepted the God of Israel, then they become a part of Israel. And what was happening with these foreign wives, they weren't accepting the God of Israel, and they weren't about to. And so God instructed them, look, if you are going to be accept something compromised like that, it's not going to go well for you or your children, and I want it to go well. So I'm taking this drastic measure in order to accomplish that. So we have to understand that the key issue here is one of idolatry. It is one of idolatry, and so they are having to make this change in order to get back on track. So Malachi takes them back to the issue, as we've seen, and he says, you have profaned the covenant of the fathers, you've dealt treacherously, and abomination has been committed. So we have words like treachery, abomination, unfaithful to the covenant, and it comes back to marriages to the daughters of a foreign god. And then he says in verse 13, this is Malachi 2, verse 13, that there is a second thing that you do. Malachi, let's start in Malachi chapter 2, verse 10. It says, have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers? Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution, which he loves. And how has he profaned it? It says he married the daughter of a foreign god. So that's what caused the profaning to take place. And it says in verse 12, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this thing, does this, being awake and aware. Yet who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts? So in this particular verse, you see a double curse. First of all, if you're going to follow this path, then you will be cut off from the tents of Jacob, and do not bring an offering because it's not going to be accepted. It's not going to be accepted by the Lord of hosts. So we see that Israel, or the people of Judah, were in a dire strait in the way that they were conducting themselves. They had compromised with God's instructions, and they were going to suffer the consequences. And when God tried to correct them, many times they did not listen. They did not listen. So Malachi has said his piece and now wants to go on to something else. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying. So he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. So what's he saying here? What's this all about? This is a separate issue that is being brought up. What he's saying in verse 13 is at the heart and core of the following verses, but it's given first of all. And the verses that come after verse 13 help to explain what's going on. What he's saying in verse 13 is it would be better understood if it came after verses 14, 15, and 16. But Malachi leads off with the problem that we see elaborated in verse 13. So what happens from verse 13 on is he's taking them to task for being unfaithful to their wives. So they're being unfaithful to their own wives. And so Malachi dealt with marrying daughters to foreign gods. Now he deals with dealing treacherously with your proper wife. You've not been treating her properly, and God deals with this now. See, basically saying you've left your Jewish wife to marry a foreign wife, or you've simply treated your Jewish wife badly. Either one of those outcomes is not what God's looking for. So the tears that we see described here are the tears of a woman who is appealing to God and asking God for his mercy and intervention with what she's having to deal with as a wife. Her husband is being unfaithful, and she is appealing to God for his intervention. And the offended woman is the one with the tears covering the altar as she's asking God for help, as I said. And God is saying, as a result of the tears of your wives, I won't accept your offering anymore. You're treating your wife like this? And then you're bringing offerings to the temple and expecting me to accept them? I won't. I won't accept that kind of behavior, and I will not accept your offering. In verse 14, we arrive at another case of pushback from the Jews. And, pushback can take various forms. For instance, you can say, well, yes, you're condemning me, but I don't agree. I don't agree with the problem. At higher levels of pushback, you could say, well, who says that I'm wrong? Or you can countercharge, you're as guilty as I am. Or you can be more subtle, and that's what we see with the Jews here. They're playing dumb. The Jews are playing dumb. They're not pushing back in verse 14. They're simply playing dumb. And that's where it says, yet you say, for what reason? For what reason are you upset with me? For what reason are you upset with us? And they're playing dumb in the hopes that God will accept that they're acting like they don't know what's going on, when in reality they do. So God responds to their playing dumb in the following way. He says, because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. And they're saying, what? What did we do wrong? So they're playing, as I said, they're playing dumb. And God says to them, I was a witness at your marriage. And as you think about getting married in the church, God is a witness of your marriage. God is a witness that you're married if you do get married in the church. And he's bringing this up. He said, I was a witness at your marriage, and I was there. And as I said, our marriage ceremony brings God right into it. He's a partner in the marriage, and is a partner in the covenant. And our marriage covenant says, our marriage ceremony says, do you covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses? That very question is asked. And the covenant is between the man and the woman and God. There are three parties to the marriage covenant. And God is noting that the wife has given her youthful years to her husband, and yet her husband is, and so basically she's saying, well, I'm stuck with you. I've given you my best years, and here I am, an older woman, and you're basically casting me aside and going to a new one. And, you know, we live in this time, and I would say that we see examples of this even in the church, sad to say. So God is letting the people of the time know that he's not happy with them at all. I mean, here you have God witnessing to being a witness at your marriage, and you are discarding your wife, and you are divorcing her and entering into a relationship with a new lady. And you think that you can get away with that. And as you look at some of the reasons why you could get a divorce in Christ's time, if your wife burnt your dinner, then you could divorce her. So, or you didn't like it, you could divorce her for almost anything. And Christ points out that that's not acceptable at all. Malachi 2, verse 15, it says, "But did he not make them one? That is, the husband and wife come together as one, having a remnant of the Spirit. And why one? He seeks godly offspring." So in a man and a woman entering into the relationship of marriage, the result that God wants, as God is involved in the marriage and the husband and the wife are being joined together as husband and wife in conjunction with God, what does God want? He wants godly offspring. That is, children who grow up in the faith and carry on the faith and live by the faith. That's what God wants. That's the outcome that he intended. And God says, "Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth." So he says, look, you need to take stock of yourself, and do not deal treacherously with your wife, because that's not the behavior that someone who's entered into covenant with me would be doing. So let me introduce to you what is going on in the verse in a little bit of different context by going into the New Testament. Let's go to, if this will help us to understand Malachi 2, verse 15. Yeah, let's go to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, and we'll begin looking at verse 3. Matthew chapter 19, verse 3. There it says, "The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, 'Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?'" And that was a premise that was commonly believed in the time of Christ. In fact, the Hebrew scholar Hillel said that very thing, that you can divorce your wife for anything. And Christ said, sorry, that may be a common thinking, but it's unacceptable. Verse 4, "And he answered and said to them, 'Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?'" He made them male and he made them female. And it's, and as you look at what it says there, it's basically one man and one lady. He's not talking about multiple women or multiple men. It's one man and one woman that God made. And he made them to join together in a marriage relationship. And so Christ goes on to say in verse 5, "And said, 'For this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.'" So they could be joined together and they were to become one flesh, physically and spiritually. And verse 6, "So then they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." So the Jews push back at Christ, and what did they say? They said to him, "Why then did Moses command a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" Well, if, okay, they're responding to Christ, they're pushing back, and they're saying, well, why did Moses say that we could have a writ of divorce and separate from our wives? And so Christ answers that in verse 8. He said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, this is because of carnal nature. It's not what I wanted. It's because of your carnal nature, I have permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. That's not what I intended at all. So for you to go ahead and divorce your wife is unacceptable behavior. So according to the commentators on Malachi chapter 2, verse 15, their view of that verse is saying, I've made them two, and two people. That we know, he made Adam and he made Eve. And God says, having a remnant of the Spirit is where a crucial bit of information comes into play. In essence, God is saying, I had enough material where I could have made 10, 100, 50. I could have made a large number of wives and husbands, but that's not how I made them. I made one man and I made one woman, and they were to be joined together and become one. And I wanted them to become one flesh. So I wanted that pairing to produce godly offspring. So God gets down to the bottom line. If I had intended that a man simply be promiscuous and tomcat around, I could have made as many Eves as I wanted to. But you realize I didn't do that. There was one Eve, there was one Adam, and they were to be joined together as husband and wife. When you couple Malachi chapter 2, verse 15, Matthew chapter 19 and John 1, it gives us a depth of understanding. And let's look at John beginning in chapter 1, verse 1. John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through him. And without him, nothing was made that was made. So John tells us that Jesus Christ was the executive officer of in the let us make man in our image verse, that Jesus is the one who's taking the action. And John is saying, if you want to know the one who did the manual labor to create the first man and woman, well, it was Jesus Christ. It's the one we know as Yahweh, the one who is the creator. The Word is saying, I didn't intend for there to be a whole lot of women for each man or vice versa. I intended for a man and a woman to be faithful to each other till death do they part. That's the way God intended it, and that is still God's intention. So God is, in his creative wisdom, knew that little children are the most absorbent sponges in the creation. So when you have a baby born, its eyes are big, and it's watching everything, and it's taking it all in. And it continues to take it all in as it grows and it matures, and it continues that path of focusing on everything going on around it as it grows up. So they just suck in everything they see. And when they see a bond of happiness between their mom and dad, they absorb it. It's just something they see, and there's no talking. There doesn't necessarily have to be training going on, but they can observe it. And they can tell the love that a man has for his wife and vice versa. You don't have to talk or teach it. They can see it and absorb it. And it goes from one generation to another. And God is saying, I designed the institution of marriage to be an institution of self-perpetuating godliness. And as you think about it, to sustain a nation and a people requires a kind of fidelity. And unfortunately, in our time, we do not have that kind of fidelity, which is crucial to the preservation of marriage and to our country as a whole. So God has introduced in this prophecy the knowledge that I, as God, am not happy that you've taken wives that have different religions, and because this dilutes your loyalty to me. And then the second point he made, and I'm not happy about your treachery to the wife of your youth, because that dilutes loyalty to me. So both of these actions bring a curse upon the person who is not loyal to God or loyal to their spouse. And then in Malachi chapter 2, verse 16, it says, "For the Lord God of Israel says he hates divorce." God hates it. That's just a fundamental principle that we understand in the church. God hates divorce, for it covers one's garments with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. So, people get divorces, and it's sad that they do, but that's something that has to be sorted out. And each person has to sort that out for themselves. And all of us have to realize if we're contemplating divorce, we have to think about God hates divorce. That's not me. That's what God had to say. He hates it, and he hates it for a reason, because of what it does to the two people involved and what it does to any children that have been born into that marriage. And as you're seeking to get a divorce many times, the divorce involves treachery. One party has been treacherous to the other, and you do not want God to be accusing you of being treacherous. Because basically, when you're treacherous and you've not repented, you're basically like the guys that go to jail. They give them an orange jumpsuit. So if you escape from the jail or prison, you're going to have on that orange jumpsuit and you're going to stick out like a sore thumb. Everybody will know that you've escaped from jail. And the same thing is true. If you are treacherous in the way you treat your husband or your wife and seek a divorce, then basically you're like that person who is on the chain gang, and you have been treacherous not only to your spouse, but to God as well. In verse 17, we have the last pushback from the Jews before the subject ends. And it says, "You have wearied the Lord with your words. Yet you say, in what way have we wearied the Lord?" How have we wearied him? In that you say, "Everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them." Or, "Where is the God of justice?" And as you think about the condition that our world is in now, as many of us recognize, we live in a lawless world now. It's lawless. And they don't recognize right from wrong in all too many cases. And they don't want to be corrected. They do not want to be corrected. They want to do whatever is right in their own sight. And God is expressing his unhappiness with such a situation. So as you look at the people who are described here as pushing back, they basically are doing whatever they have to do to push back against God. And they're pushing back against God and basically telling God, we're going to do what we want. So, and we want your endorsement. If you won't give us your endorsement, then move on. And so it's a pretty negative state that the people that are being described here are in. So in conclusion, as we look at the world in which we live, we might conclude that, God makes the rules and expects us to follow them. And he's looking at us and looking at the world. And basically, he tells all of us, you either play by my rules, or then we will separate, and you'll go your way and I'll go mine. So it's up to you what you're going to do. And where are we as a nation? I think that's the issue of whether we're going to follow God or not is being decided. It's being decided right here and right now. And as you look at the condition that we are in as a nation, it's pretty serious. And as you look at the way that people are living, they're definitely pushing against God, whether they recognize God or not, but they are pushing against God and showing God what their true intentions are. So that concludes the second part of the book of Malachi. And so next Wednesday, we'll go ahead and we'll do part three of the book of Malachi, and we'll continue through the book. It's a book that is chock full of valuable information for us as end time Christians, and hopefully we'll learn the lessons that are found there, and we can implement them in our lives. So thanks everybody for joining the Bible study this evening.